Charles Quinn, NBC News, Washington.
Listen again on the hour when Stuckey's Roadside Refreshment Centers bring you NBC Monitor News.
The San Francisco Story, brought to you by Jenkel Davidson Optical Company, serving all of Northern California. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bud Heide, inviting you to be the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for another half hour of the stories of San Francisco, the story-making towns and hills that surround it, and the people who made San Francisco's past so colorful. These impressions, written by Samuel Dixon, are brought to you each Sunday morning at this time by Jenkel Davidson, stylists in eyewear with offices throughout Northern California. We hope you enjoy today's story. You know, there's something shady going on these days at Jenkel Davidson. Oh, but it's all on the up and up. All shades of sunglasses are what's going on, you see. Going on smart people who know that the right kind of sunglasses can make a difference between what you do to your eyes and what you do for your eyes. Sunglasses from Jenkel Davidson contain only the finest optically ground lenses, plain or prescription. They're scientifically developed and tested to make sure they reduce glare without distortion. Any other kind could do your eyes an injustice. And speaking of justice, you'll be pleased with what Jenkel Davidson sunglasses do for your sense of style. They come in all shapes, colors, and moods, from plain to fancy, tame to wild. So, for something new under the sun, make a shady deal with Jenkel Davidson. There's a convenient office near you, and bank credit cards are honored. Now to our story. Going to the Mechanics Mercantile Library for the past 70 years. And because time, with its puckish humor, plays queer tricks with our imagination, it seems to us that the same faces have been behind the desk all those years. Faces that were no younger 70 years ago and are no older today. As a matter of fact, that is one of the qualities of the library, a quality shared with two or three other institutions. There are certain churches and certain old French restaurants and certain saloons that retain the flavor they had 40 and 50 and 60 years ago. They, with the library, have spanned the years of the city's growth and retained the serene, dignified Victorian essence of their early days. Take the chess room of the library for an example. For the benefit of the newcomer to the city, we first should explain that the library occupies its own building at 57 Post Street, just below Kearney, and the chess room is on the fourth floor. You might go in there tomorrow, or you may have gone in 1935 or 1925 or 1915, and the same faces would be gathered at the chess tables, intensely intent. In the old days, no one looked up when you entered. If you were a stranger, you were probably ignored. Today, of course, you are made welcome, but there are very few words spoken in the chess room. The life of a chess addict is a serious business and not to be disturbed by casual neophytes or the profane. In all the years that we frequented the chess room, we recall only one of the old guard who moved swiftly. He was lame. He walked with a decided limp, but he would rush limping into the room, plunge at a table, grab a victim, make three or four moves with lightning rapidity, and plunge out of the room, limping, leaving his defeated opponent with the depressed expression of a chronic dyspeptic. But of course, he was the exception. The regulars move slowly to the tables, move the pieces slowly across the boards, and if they take 20 or 30 minutes between moves, well, that is as it should be. Chess is a serious business and a fine art to be approached with respect and restrained dignity. Of course, the Mechanics Mercantile Library is far more than a chess room. It had its beginning in 1854, 114 years ago. The new city was just beginning to feel its maturity. The shacks and tents were disappearing. Brick and wooden houses and industrial buildings were taking their place. Culture was being welcomed, and the arts and sciences. San Francisco had been a mushroom mining camp, growing to strength and stature overnight. But differing from the traditional mining camp, it was destined to endure when the cry of gold had been silenced. So, in 1854, a group of far-seeing men met to plan an association to aid in the advancement of the mechanical arts and sciences. They called the association the Mechanics Institute. And in 1855, they decided a library was needed, and it was started at once with four volumes. One was the Bible, one was the Constitution of the United States, and there were two volumes of science. By the end of 1855, the library had increased to 100 volumes, and when in 1906 the fire destroyed the institution, its library consisted of more than 200,000 volumes. They, with priceless and irreplaceable records and documents, were destroyed, and the past 62 years has seen the rebuilding of the library to one of the most valuable collections in the land. Valuable, yes, and a wide and a great collection. Stack upon stack devoted to the sciences, to art, to music and history and biography, as well as to fiction. But further than that, the Mechanics has one asset in which it differs from almost all other libraries. That is the privilege extended to the membership of going directly to the stacks to seek and select the required books. And of course, this couldn't be allowed in a public library. Chaos would follow. We have had occasion to go to the public library for books on varying subjects. And when, let us say, we wanted information about Abraham Lincoln and found several hundred volumes dealing directly or indirectly with the martyred president, all carefully indexed in the catalog, it became a complicated problem. We couldn't say to the young lady behind the desk, "Will you please let me see these several hundred volumes? Just trot them out, and I'll look them over." Although in our own case, we have approached the librarian of the public library, convinced him of the importance of our research, and on several occasions, we were given the privilege of going directly to the stacks. We were ushered down hallways and through doors without labels. We came to the stacks and found the books we wanted, and then spent a half hour trying to find our way back to civilization, or at least to the main thoroughfares of the library building. We like books. We have always liked books. But to us, in our youth, the Mechanics' fairs that were the financial props of the Mechanics Institute were of major interest and importance. We've mentioned them before, the fairs that in our day were held in the building between Polk and Larkin Streets and Grove and Hayes, a block south of the present City Hall. We remember nothing of the science that was featured in the fairs. We remember little of the art. But we will always remember the joy of going from booth to booth and exhibit to exhibit and being handed pamphlets and picture books of Western industries. We particularly remember fair soap and certain brands of whiskey. We were 9 years old at that time, and we remember the samples of crackers that were given away and the samples of perfume and the samples of celluloid toothpicks. We remember the strange invention that was demonstrated on the balcony. It was called the antimatoscope. Animated pictures. Yes, those were the first pictures in motion made by a mass of unjoined pictures being shuffled before a stereopticon lantern. And we could buy, for a few cents, a small booklet about an inch square or 2 inches square, and by running our thumb over the edge of the pages so that they turned quickly, chasing a cat or two prize fighters fighting, or a tight-corseted lady in a dress with leg of mutton sleeves being kissed by a gentleman. Well, of course, by this time, the Mechanics' Fair had been a long-established tradition in San Francisco. For the first fair was held in 1857. But it was in 1864 that the fair really came into its own. A huge pavilion was built on the present site of Union Square, and as a feature of the Institute, promenade concerts were held. At the concerts, the audience promenaded, and if they didn't enjoy the musical offering, they talked and looked at exhibits and admired the fashionable dress of the ladies and ate peanuts. To the promenade concerts as featured artist came the lady violinist Camilla Urso. Madame Urso was a good violinist in her own right, but she amplified her art with an orchestra of 200 musicians and 1,200 choral singers. This was, however, 5 years after the first pavilion had been erected at Union Square. The present one was larger and more imposing. And when Camilla played and the 200 musicians joined in, augmented by 1,200 singing voices, Ambrose Bierce, the town crier of that day, said the noise was terrific. There wasn't a moment during those three terrible days you could have heard the spanking of an infant, a relaxation to which we are most partial. But that noise was child's play compared with the time that Madame Camilla rendered the Anvil Chorus from Il Trovatore, and the Presidio, cannon in the Presidio were synchronized with each crash of the operatic anvil. There were six mechanisms with which we were familiar in our youthful days, was, as we have said, on Larkin Street. It housed the fairs, it housed six-day bicycle races, it housed various other civic and non-civic events, and eventually on April 18th in 1906, it became the haven for thousands of refugees fleeing from the flames of the city and a shelter for the sick and the injured. It was a large building, and why it was assumed that a huge structure would be invulnerable to flames, we have never discovered. The flames, however, traveled out Hayes Valley, and the pavilion went up in the Holocaust. However, the Mechanics Institute was wedded that very year, 1906, to the Mercantile Library Association, and the present organization came into being. Now, there is one detail we have omitted in the story of the Mechanics Library, and that is that during its years of nourishing the culture-starved minds of the West, it was hard put itself to find money to buy its own bread and butter. After all, the body cannot live on art and culture alone. Well, that pavilion site between Polk and Larkin Streets went far to solve the financial problems of the association. Went so far, in fact, that it has been a comfortable matron ever since. The lot cost the association $175,000 in 1881. In 1912, with the project of a Panama Pacific Exposition in the offing, the city decided to build itself an impressive civic center. And the lot formerly occupied by the Mechanics Institute Pavilion was a part of the land desired for the center. And the city purchased it therewith from the association for $700,000. There was, however, one other event that placed the Mechanics Institute fairly squarely on its two cultured feet, and that event was one of the most amazing in the amazing history of this amazing city. It was, incidentally, inspired by that amazing genius of San Francisco's youthful gay days, Bill Ralston. We'll get back to our story in a moment. Ever notice how you feel as fresh as your eyes? If they're tired, then the same feeling comes stealing all over, dulling your alertness and diminishing your enjoyment. That bleary feeling can, of course, be caused by a lot of things, from a day at the desk to a night on the town. But in most cases, fatigue is the result of overdoing it at one thing or another. And when it happens now and then, it's usually a sign to change the subject, your eyes rest. If it happens fairly often, it might be a sign to need a medical eye examination, just to be sure you're not making greater demands on your eyes than they can naturally handle. Remember, to medical eye doctor for the best in eye care, look to Jenkel Davidson for the best in eyewear. Bank credit cards are honored at Jenkel Davidson offices throughout Northern California. Now, back to our story. ¶¶ The year was 1870, and the Mercantile Library was staggering under a debt of $250,000. So the state of California was petitioned for permission, and the Mercantile Library was granted permission to hold a great concert with a state-legalized lottery. One half of the receipts of the concert was to pay off the library's indebtedness. The other half was to go to the winners of the lottery prizes. When Bill Ralston wanted a thing done, it was done, and in a hurry. And a bill was rushed through the legislature legalizing the lottery. 200,000 tickets were sold to the concert at $5 apiece. A handsome box office indeed. $1 million was realized, one half of it for the debts of the library, one half to be distributed in prizes, commencing with a first prize of $100,000, the second of $50,000, a third of $25,000, and then in diminishing amounts until the $500,000 was consumed. The lottery tickets were to go on sale in June of 1870. The lottery was announced in February. And for 4 months, the city was divided into two raging camps. The faction that thought the lottery was a fine thing and a wise, and the faction that condemned gambling in all forms and raged that a cultured, a refined, a polite, and gentle citadel of civic pride should demean itself by fostering sin. Every place you went, you could start or find an argument on the subject. From the pulpits, good men denounced the infamous plot. At dinner tables in genteel Pacific Heights homes, children and parents shouted each other down in their approval or disapproval of the lottery. And the hundreds of saloons that graced the city, hundreds of fights resulted from the lottery fever. But when all was said and done and all the blows delivered and all the fights ended, 200,000 tickets had been sold at $5 apiece. The climax came, of course, with the concert, which started in the pavilion at 9 o'clock in the morning on October 31st and ended at 3 o'clock in the morning of November 1st. A half dozen different bands and orchestras relieve each other at three-hour intervals. At noon of October 31st, tens of thousands of San Franciscans tried to fight their way into the pavilion, and countless thousands more milled hour upon hour at the door. A special committee of prominent citizens occupied the platform where the drawing was to be held. And finally, at the appointed hour, a blind girl. But perhaps it would be best if we quoted now from the local press. So we read, "First of all, the blind girl dipped her hand into the wheel and drew out the leather tag of fortune, which she held aloft. At the same moment, a blind boy drew from the other wheel a box containing the corresponding number. Mr. Smiley then advanced with his hands behind him, did not touch the number, and read it aloud twice." The same number was then called out in numerals to a man recording it on a huge placard. And as we write, the agony of suspense draws to a close. The streets are full of those who arose this morning full of hope and are still watching as the last drops fall from the urn of fate, still clinging to the idea that fortune will smile with her tinier morsels at the ending. So ends the quotation. The first prize, $100,000 in gold coin, was paid to Mr. Theodore Hellman. Joseph Schmidt's orchestra played the Grand Gallop, All Are Satisfied, by Gungel. And the Mercantile Library, its debts behind it, entered its full estate as a handsome, dignified pillar of San Francisco's art and culture to grow into a serene dowager, a joy to all who love books and the good things to be found within them. Thank you. Who hasn't pondered this question at one time or another? Which of my five senses would I hate the most to lose? And who hasn't concluded that the saddest loss would be the sense of sight? In the last analysis, it is, of course, our ability to see that relates us most strongly to the world around us, that allows us to get our bearings most specifically, that enables us to learn and enjoy most abundantly. That's why your sixth sense should tell you to guard your vision as carefully as humanly possible. And lucky for us all, the realm of what is possible in preserving and improving our vision is greater today than ever before, thanks to constant advances in the field of ophthalmology. Ophthalmology is that branch of medicine that deals with the functions and the diseases of the eye. Because of it, your chances of retaining good vision throughout your life are much better than they were just a generation ago. Provided, of course, you use your sixth sense and visit an ophthalmologist every 18 months or so for a medical eye examination. Remember, look to your medical eye doctor for eye care. Look to Jenkel Davidson for eye wear. You have been the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for the San Francisco story. The men and women of Jenkel Davidson hope that you have enjoyed today's program and that you will join us again next week at 9:05 when we shall begin a three-part story of one of the great builders of the West, John Charles Fremont. Many of these stories are to be found in Samuel Dixon's book, Tales of San Francisco, on sale at all bookstores. This is Bud Heide, speaking for the Jenkel Davidson Optical Company with offices throughout Northern California.
This is KNBR, AM and FM in San Francisco. The A's and the Senators play baseball this afternoon at the Coliseum. Broadcast time of KNBR will be 1:10 this afternoon.
Lift out the trumpet and loud let it ring. Jesus is coming again. Pilgrims, be joyful and sing. Jesus is coming again.
This is the voice of prophecy, a voice crying in the wilderness of these modern days, prepare ye the way of the Lord.
Coming again, coming again. Is coming again.
From our Voice of Prophecy studios in Los Angeles, California, this is Dave Olson to welcome you to this half hour of inspiration. You will hear the music of the King's Herald's Quartet, Del Delker and Brad Braley. The Voice of Prophecy speaker is HMS Richards.